This is 1A. I'm John Donvan, and in for Joshua Johnson in Washington. And we are just 3 months into 2018, and already some big tech companies are facing a reckoning. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg says he's going to appear before Congress in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Twitter is promising to reduce dramatically the impact of those services that deploy huge teams of bots. Those are those automated accounts that impersonate real users. But one massive platform has largely escaped the backlash. YouTube reaches more than 80% of internet users. But between racist vloggers and crisis actor claims and one network star showing millions of his followers an actual corpse, YouTube has been having a very bad year. So how did the website go from this, its first ever video in 2005?
So here we are, in front of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long fronts, and that's cool.
To its most popular vlogger using the N-word in 2017.
What a n***. Jeez, oh my God, what the f***. I don't mean that in a bad way, Jesus.
A powerful combination of advanced algorithms and payments to creators keeps people posting. But even though YouTube controls the servers and the checkbook, does YouTube really control its content? And should it? Our guests will help us answer that question in just a moment.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from GoToMeeting. It's the simple, flexible, collaborative meeting tool that works for you so you can focus on getting work done. Trusted by 18 million monthly users, GoToMeeting lets you connect on the go from any device so you can move work forward from anywhere in the world. To learn how your company can make the switch today, visit GoToMeeting.com.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Louise Matsakis covers security and social platforms for Wired. She joins us from NPR in New York. Louise, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Renee DiResta is a policy specialist with Data for Democracy. That's where she researches computational propaganda and disinformation. And she's joining us from KQED in San Francisco. Renee, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, Anthony D'Angelo represents the Internet Creators Guild, an organization that is designed to represent and to support YouTubers themselves. He also uploads his own videos on the channel Lego Shark Productions. Anthony, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, Louise, for those of us who may not be into YouTube, the 20% of people who aren't online but not necessarily using YouTube, how big is it these days?
It's huge. It's the biggest video platform on the internet. It's basically taken over TV, like the role of TV, I think, for a lot of people, especially native internet users. Hundreds of hours of video are uploaded every single minute. So you can understand how hard it is to manage a platform of that size. And unlike something like Twitter or Facebook, where a lot of the posts are text-based, it's a lot harder for machine learning algorithms to sort through, you know, sometimes what are hour-long videos. It's much harder. So I think that's kind of you know, the overview of what YouTube is like.
And what the scope of kinds of, again, for those who don't get onto YouTube, the scopes of the kinds of material that shows up there is from what to what to what?
I think what people should realize is that they're like native celebrities, so that this is the only platform they've ever known, and they have, you know, wider audiences than NPR. You know, there are some creators on there who make makeup videos or who just make funny prank videos or who talk about politics. Or who make, you know, nature videos or how-to videos. There really is a wide breadth. There's really a YouTuber for every interest and every genre. And they are massive. You know, some of these people have millions of subscribers and millions of fans.
So there's that whole aspect of it. But then there are a lot of complaints, Renee, also, that there's this darker side to the YouTube experience. And talk a little bit about the stuff that's not so pleasant.
Sure. So I think over the last maybe 6 months now, there's been a number of investigations into what's on the social platforms, things that began in earnest after the Russia problem, so to speak, became more widely known. So that ranged from everything from propaganda to misleading videos to YouTube has historically had a problem with extremist content. People began really kind of digging in again to see how much of the extremist content had been dealt with. There was then a number of exposés on YouTube Kids and the content that was put deliberately into channels that were marketed to children, their own separate app marketed to children, having some violent, kind of snuff film type caliber, bizarre cartoons and things like that. So there was just a sense that there was this sort of seedy underbelly to the platform that was not being adequately dealt with, despite claims to the contrary.
Anthony, you have been on YouTube since 2007. Have you seen the culture of the experience of being both a user and a creator change in those 11 years?
Well, sure. I think when I signed up, a big kind of motivator was this idea that media democratization was the way of the future, that if everyone had a camera in their hand, that you would see a radical social transformation, right? That power would be taken out of the hands of the big TV networks and so on, and into the hands of the people, and that would be a source of change in the world. And I think that what people didn't really anticipate was that when you give everyone video cameras, you're also giving like Nazis video cameras, mm-hmm. And that's a problem. So you've got this open platform that where the barriers to entry are lowered and where anyone can have a voice, and you know that has its positives and its negatives. And I think that certainly it should be a big part of the conversation about democracy and data and media literacy especially.
Oh, here's a sample of some of what we're just talking about now.
Well, according to FBI crime statistics at FBI.gov, no one died in 2012 in Sandy Hook. It shows no homicides in that town.
What I've got for you today here is a bombshell, okay? It's explosive proof that all these events were false flags.
There's lots of pictures of allegedly David Hoag, allegedly now.
9/11, one of the world's most tragic events ever happened. Over 3,000 people died this day. But who caused it? Terrorists or the government of the United States itself?
So those were clips from four YouTube channels, and those four videos alone have been viewed more than 6 million times and liked roughly 28,000 times. And Louise, is there a simple answer to the question of how that stuff gets there?
No, I mean, I think that on any major internet platform, any social platform, there's always going to be, you know, user-generated content that a lot of us don't agree with. But I think one of the main reasons that those videos have so many views is because of something unique to YouTube, which is the well, it's not unique to YouTube, but it's a big part of the platform is the recommendation algorithm, which if you're watching a video, a normal, maybe like a BBC clip or something about 9/11 or, you know, an NPR clip about 9/11, in the recommendations, you might see a conspiracy theory video. And this happens not just with politically charged topics like, you know, or known conspiracy theory. It happens with fairly generic topics. Like sometimes if you're watching a video about vegetarianism, it'll give you a video about veganism and then one about some guy who only drinks water. The recommendation algorithm is often incentivized to keep you on the platform, and it often drives users to more extreme content.
And Renee, how powerful and important is this recommendation algorithm? How influential is it?
So we are pretty good at gauging the kind of consumption of content, the hours consumed. We can look at things like likes. What we're interested in, what we try to understand, and what really I want to emphasize that only YouTube fully understands, is what extent these videos have on actually influencing people. Meaning, do they come back to the site looking for a video about that content the next time? So if I see that 9/11 truther video, do I come back to the site and start at 9/11 truther videos the next time I have an hour to kill? That's something that it's very, very difficult for anyone outside of the platforms to know. And that's why many of us who work in the policy area believe that it is actually the platform's responsibility to do a better job understanding the content that it hosts. That's because these recommendation engines are a curatorial function. This is something that they have built, the system that generates the recommendations. And that's why we feel that to a large extent, they are responsible for what it serves, not necessarily for the content and for what they're hosting, but for what they are for what they are proactively serving people.
And who benefits from the use of that algorithm most?
The platform does, because the tech platforms compete with each other in the sense that they're all attention brokers. Mm. So their job is to keep you on site as long as possible, which is why the recommendation engine in particular across all platforms has the same function whereby it's doing, it's doing kind of one of two things. It's either showing you videos or content that are similar to videos or content that you've personally consumed before, or it's doing what's known as collaborative filtering, where it's showing you videos and content that are similar to things that people who are like you also like. And so these are the two ways that, sometimes it's a combination of the two. The specific weighting of the algorithm itself is proprietary to the company. But ultimately, what it's trying to do is keep you enticed and keep you interested, and because serving you ad roll is how it makes its money.
I want to go back to Anthony, because you're more inside the process than anybody else. Walk us through the steps you have to take to become a YouTube creator.
If there were a single sort of path towards becoming a successful YouTube creator, I think, a lot more people would be very successful with it. But I think that for a lot of people, it's, a lot of people gain fame sort of accidentally, and they realize, well, this is a thing that I can run with. A lot of people have started out and like made it a goal to build an audience, and they've succeeded, and that's cool, because you want people to be able to practice their passion for a living. But I think that at the Internet Creators Guild, sort of what we're trying to do is promote and protect the value of that work. Mm-hmm. That it's not just bad actors like the Jake Pauls and et cetera of the world. That within creators, there's a strong contingent of people who are really strong social activists and people with a lot of really cool radical ideas. So it's not only this force for evil, I suppose.
No, I hear you. And as I said at the beginning, a lot of us get a lot of benefit out of the things that we see, learn, are amused by, entertained by, informed by on YouTube. So let's say, let's take it off the negative for a moment. Just say I'm a musician and I want to set up a channel and build a following. Walk us through that process. What would you do?
Sure. Well, so yeah, you would sign up, you make an account, you'd start uploading. Typically, you want to be working on a pretty regular schedule so that your audience can sort of get acclimated to, expecting what type of content you're putting out and how often. Over time, you want to build, if you want to build an audience, you probably want to collaborate with people who've got large audiences than you. You can sort of do certain data optimization techniques, sort of work within the algorithm to increase your chances of success. Mm-hmm. So tagging things a certain way, titling your videos a certain way, using certain keywords in your descriptions. There's a lot of different sort of ways to work within that system.
And where's the point where you begin to make money, if that's your goal?
So it used to be that anyone could advertise on their YouTube videos. Recently, the sort of threshold for who could do that was raised to 4,000 hours of watch time and 1,000 subscribers, I believe is the number.
What's the impact of that raising of the threshold?
Well, I think for one, it's sort of a disincentive for, anyone who, I think it requires you to have, some skin in the game, right? If you're going to pursue this as a career, you really need to want it. Like, getting to those thresholds is a really tough thing to do. I mean, I used to be in the partner program myself, and my channel doesn't reach those thresholds, and so I was removed. And that's that's kind of a bummer, because, I started out in 2007 and gained partnership in 2010. And so there's this problem where creators sort of are subject to major changes on content platforms. If they become too reliant on a single factor, if it changes, then that could be really disruptive to your business.
Does YouTube negotiate and work with people like you, or does it just tell you what the rules are? The rules change and that's the end of the story.
Generally, it's their kind of move. The changes sort of come from within them, and I think that's partially because creators haven't had a really strong collective action sort of mechanism for collective action yet. And that's what the SAG is trying to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what we're trying to talk with YouTube about at the sort of executive level. How can the interests of creators, the values of creators, be represented in the products that they produce, and that includes the algorithm.
Janet Webb tweets, you're asking the wrong question. Does the network want to stop its toxic content? The answer is no. That's what Janet Webb's saying. Louise, what do you think of that? Does YouTube actually have a conflict of interest when it comes to the fact that its profitability comes from views and views might come from toxic content?
Yeah, I think that they definitely, you know, don't want to limit how you search content, how you find content. I don't think that they want to be in that position. But I think more so than just the incentive, you know, conspiracy theory content, like Anthony said, is like a really small, like this toxic content, like is a small portion of YouTube. Like the vast majority of YouTube is fairly innocuous or positive. But I think that the incentive they have really is that they don't want to be seen as the arbiter of truth. They really don't want to be in a position where they're seen as more than a distribution platform, which of course they are. They're designing these algorithms that are proprietary, which are weighting certain content in certain ways, which I would argue is an editorial decision. But they want to be seen as, you know, the other day the CEO of YouTube said this at South by Southwest that she thinks of YouTube as a library and all they're doing is just curating, and that it's just distribution. Anyone can put whatever they want in the library. And I would argue that, you know, librarians are, you know, they make editorial decisions about how content should be organized, how it should be accessed, what should and shouldn't be in the library. So I think that that analogy kind of fails. And I also think, you know, on the transparency, we don't know how these algorithms work. We don't know what effect they necessarily have on people. And I think the net kind of consequence for creators is that they don't always know. I mean, Anthony, you can speak to this better than I can, but they don't always know why their channel isn't able to run ads anymore, why it got demonetized. Your entire channel being removed is not usually what happens, but sometimes you'll find that a certain video or your entire channel has been demonetized, meaning that it can't run ads any longer or you can't run ads in a specific video, and you're not necessarily aware of why that might have happened. For example, I think it was last year or maybe in 2016, they made it so that it's really hard to monetize videos that have profanity in them, which was a major change. So all of a sudden, a bunch of videos that included any cursing were suddenly demonetized. And it was hard to know where the line was there. You know, what is considered profanity? What words can you say? What words can't you say? Like, when does it become too sexual of a conversation? And I think that's really murky. And I think that YouTube is in a really tough spot because it doesn't want to draw those lines. It doesn't want to be seen as deciding what's true and what's not.
Renee DiResta, as we said in the beginning, we've seen Twitter called on the carpet in a big way in the past year, Facebook definitely in a very big way. I want to point out, we haven't said it yet, that YouTube is owned by the company that owns Google. Does an organization such as yours, Data for Democracy, have an avenue of influence with them in terms of asking for, seeking, and getting greater transparency for them? Are they impregnable?
So they did get called to the carpet. Google did testify in the various hearings, especially examining the Russia problem. There were two hearings about Russia, then there was one about terrorism, and then I believe we've got a third coming up on April 10th that is going to be about privacy, and it's not totally clear who's going to be attending that one yet. YouTube did have Russian content on the site. It was not very much. It was, I think, 1,100 videos or something, 43 hours worth of content. When you ask about outside researchers, so Data for Democracy, we see our role as a collection of outside researchers as holding the platforms accountable by doing investigations that they are unable or unwilling to do themselves. And there has been a marked shift since the tech hearings, but leading up to the tech hearings, a lot of the investigation into what was on the platform was done by third-party researchers. Mm-hmm. And that included pulling down pathways and cascades by which people were recommended extremist links, or looking at terrorist videos. There were bomb-making materials, ISIS content, extremist influencers. We know that the Manchester bomber watched bomb-making videos on YouTube. Now, there are ways that we can go kind of back-channel and say to engineers and to data scientists that we know at the company, hey, you might want to have a look at this. And that's
are they
sort
receptive
of thing.
To that? In the back-channel way, are they receptive?
Concerned? The engineers are, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I would say that about Facebook and Twitter as well. There are a lot of really good people who work in these companies who sincerely believe in the value of the platform and yet also recognize that the laissez-faire approach taken by management over the past, in some cases, you know, close to a decade, has gotten us to a place that we don't want to be. But the individuals who work within the companies really are trying to make a difference.
Renee, do you think it's time for some form of regulation?
Yes, I do. I think that where we are as a country with our, you know, elected bodies means that regulation is going to be a challenge. I think that it's also not entirely clear what regulation makes the most sense right now. There are a lot of policy conversations going on in the Valley about this. I think in the meantime, though, in the short term, we are really trying to prevail upon the companies themselves to take more tangible steps and offering them suggestions related to certain product surfaces and features they have that are problematic. You know, someone mentioned the CEO of YouTube at South By. The solution that they offered up for dealing with their conspiratorial and crisis actor videos was to point people to Wikipedia links, and they didn't tell Wikipedia that they were going to do it. Now it was one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. This is
let me play the clip of the YouTube executive talking about that at South by Southwest.
When there are videos that have that are focused around something that's a conspiracy, and we're using a list of well-known internet conspiracies from Wikipedia that we will show as a companion unit next to the mm-hmm. video, information from Wikipedia showing that here is information from Wikipedia about this event.
So, Renee, that goes precisely to what you were talking about. Well, YouTube announced that its solution to these kinds of problematic videos would be to pair them with entries from Wikipedia that would correct or change or alter the user's understanding of the larger context. And as you're saying, Wikipedia had no idea that this was going to be said, right?
Right. So Wikipedia didn't know. Wikipedia also, you know, is editable by anyone, which means that any conspiracy theorist who has decided that they don't like the fact that Wikipedia is challenging their conspiratorial content on YouTube is now incentivized to go and try to edit the Wikipedia link. Wikipedia is a nonprofit. It is moderated by volunteers. So this is YouTube, $75, $80 billion company, effectively turning over moderation decisions and basically passing the buck to a nonprofit staffed by volunteers, and not even giving them the heads up that it's incentivized the conspiracist hordes to descend upon the pages and start making edits.
Louise, how has that solution played out?
So I wrote about this a lot, and I heard after I published two stories about this issue, I heard back from several Wikipedia editors who are responsible for policing those pages, and they say that it's a lot of work, and that, you know, keeping conspiracy theorists away from these pages is difficult, and, you know, it's time consuming, and it's unpaid labor. You know, Wikipedia is one of the great wonders of the internet, that it's this nonprofit encyclopedia that is largely very accurate and good at its job, and I think that it really says something that, you know, this giant corporation has chosen to offload their moderation efforts. You know, I think that it is worth pointing out that Google does donate to the Wikipedia Foundation, mm-hmm. but I don't know if that's really enough. You know, they didn't form a formal partnership. And I think this really just goes back to the fact that YouTube doesn't want to be the arbiter of truth. They want to point you in another direction. And kind of what I worry about with the solution from on a technological level is that I think if you see a conspiracy theory video in the future and it doesn't have that Wikipedia link, that will signal to users, oh, this is true. I don't know if it will necessarily incentivize you to click on the link, but if you don't see the link, you'll be like, oh, well, it doesn't have that disputed, you know, signal. So I'm going to trust this. And I worry that is the end result. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't know necessarily the psychological effect of these videos on people. We know that they're, you know, consumed a lot, but we don't know necessarily what their effect is. So I do worry that it's, you know, problematic. And I hope that YouTube is working on, you know, more solutions that that they are going to take responsibility for. I think it's also worth pointing out that they're beefing up their moderation efforts, and they said that they're going to be hiring, you know, they're going to have 10,000 moderators total.
Anthony,
by the end of the year.
How do your members feel about being moderated? In other words, by that I mean having people look at the stuff they do and pass yes or no, it can go through.
Well, I think that, like, kind of fundamentally at issue here is the question of, like, whether machine learning is the correct solution for governing content at that scale, right? So, like, a lot of folks I know, colleagues of mine, LGBTQ positive educational content, right? Like, they've been demonetized or moderated, I guess, in that sense, and they see that as a form of discrimination. The algorithm, you know, can't tell if this is, you know, talking about sexual identity in a you know, positive way, or if it's pornography. You can't distinguish between the two. So, you know, if you're going to you know, solve this sort of social problem of misinformation with a technological solution. You're basically saying, okay, we want to reduce the amount of misinformation to which people are exposed to by building systems that can identify and suppress information. What I worry about is that if you're Alex Jones, right, you see that that concerted effort on the part of the platforms to suppress your mm-hmm. perspective, that's sort of water on the grease fire of misinformation, right? So I think underlying conspiracy theories is sort of less of a tacit like acceptance of falsehoods as truth, but more of an active rejection of other sort of institutionalized systems of knowledge production.
Okay, coming up, we'll get more deeply into this topic of if YouTube accepts responsibility for what's on YouTube, what would that actually mean in practice? We're going to be back in just a minute. I'm John Donvan. Stay close.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we get back to our conversation, we wanted to let you know about something exciting that I'm doing this weekend. Exciting and a little bit scary. Normally, I'm the one who's asking the questions, right? But this Sunday morning, I'll be on the other side of the table as a panelist on Meet the Press on NBC. We will be recapping the week's headlines, and now I'm really going to understand what our panelists deal with every day. I've been on MTP Daily on MSNBC a few times, but this is the big show. So please come support me, pray for me. It is Easter Sunday, after all, as I join the panel on Meet the Press this Sunday morning on your local NBC station. Check your listings, and please, set your DVR.
We have an email from Emily who says, ugh, we used to love watching Kinder Surprise egg opening videos as a family, but now my 5 and 7-year-olds have become certifiable YouTube addicts. They can sit for hours watching the most inane content. It has done nothing but create strife and feed their desire for toys. Well, you know, I don't know if that's a YouTube problem, because I remember that same argument being made about television 20 years ago. So, but that kind of, for me, raises the question, is YouTube a different creature from television in terms of its impact on, overall? I mean, it's two-way. It's really a social experience in a way, Renee, that television never was, isn't it?
It's a social experience. More than that, it's a targeting experience. So I have a 4-year-old. And we used to show him YouTube videos of garbage trucks. He was obsessed with garbage trucks when he was about 2. And there really is, it turns out, nowhere else on the internet to find hour-long videos of people who have recorded garbage trucks, but YouTube has it. So we would let him watch that. And now if you ask him what his favorite app is at 4, he'll tell you YouTube, which leaves me kind of vaguely embarrassed sometimes as a parent. But the thing that you know, the Kinder Egg illusion, I have also noticed this. It will... You as a parent want to feel that you start with, you know, you leave your kid watching a garbage truck video while you're trying to make dinner or something, and this is something that parents used to do with their children in front of TV, but you're never really sure what's going to pop up next. And because the autoplay is so unpredictable, and I as a parent can't gate that content, I can't say, I would really like to just filter out the unboxing videos. I would really just like to filter out the toy videos. So the consumer doesn't have a great degree of control. And at least when it was kind of TV programming, you had a sense of what program was up next. You could go look at the TV guide. So right now we have an interesting situation where it's social, but it's also unpredictable, and it's also incredibly well targeted, meaning that it does, you know, the recommendation engine is sophisticated enough to show people what it thinks that they're likely to want to see and to keep them there.
And I'm thinking that this issue is so enormously complicated. You know, if there's a man who believes the earth is flat, he can go to the local supermarket and hand out pamphlets that say the earth is flat. But does it become different if that guy puts up a video that gets 12 million views? If you agree with me that the earth is not flat, and therefore, using a phrase you just used, misinformation and truth, that's not the truth, on YouTube, should he be stopped? And first of all, should he be stopped by anybody? And should YouTube be curating him out of existence as a YouTuber, I mean?
Well, no. What I think, the experiment that I would like to see run, actually, is if I go and, as a user, am a, you know, inclined to believe that the Earth is flat, and I go and I type in flat Earth videos, and I have signaled to the platform that I want to see flat Earth videos, by all means, show me the flat Earth videos. But if I am just a person who happens to be watching content, and I am instead sent down this kind of increasingly conspiratorial rabbit hole of content actively promoted by the platform, then at that point, the platform, the choice architecture inherent in the platform, is proactively serving up that content. So when we look at things like radicalization pathways, a lot of what we do is we go back and we look at where things went from being more moderate and into the sort of gradual progression into the conspiratorial. I can say when I look at Facebook groups, for example, if I'm a member of an anti-vaccine Facebook group, it starts to serve chemtrails. It starts to serve Pizzagate. It starts to serve anti-government conspiracies. And funny enough, it starts to serve flat earther groups. And that's because the recommendation engines know that there's a correlation between these things. People who have one belief are likely to have others. And because they want to keep people on the platform, they're serving them. As I mentioned earlier, this kind of collaborative filtering mechanism is serving them what people who are like them have an affinity for. So this is where we have to ask, is this necessarily the prioritization function that we want our algorithms optimizing for? Is it just to give people what they want to see? Is it just to keep them on site? Or is it perhaps to say that maybe, much like the analogy of the librarians earlier on, there is some value, societal value, to more sophisticated curatorial algorithms?
Luis Matsakis, of course, YouTube depends on outside sponsors, companies that buy ads on YouTube. Are those companies potentially a source of pushback against the kinds of problems we're talking about?
In some, several of the scandals that YouTube has suffered, like especially with some of the more like radical political videos, you did see a brief advertiser exodus where they did, you know, briefly leave the platform. But it's a really great place to reach people. And, you know, video ads are much more engaging than a lot of other forms of advertisements on the web. So I don't think you're necessarily going to see a lot of advertiser pushback. I think there has been some, but I think that the biggest kind of force against YouTube, I think, in the last year has really been independent researchers and journalists. And what I'm really hoping is that we move beyond the point that we're at now, where I feel like half of tech journalism is just journalists and outside researchers doing the work of content moderation for the platforms. Like almost all of these major scandals weren't, it wasn't YouTube saying, hey, we have this problem, we're going to try and deal with it. It was journalists and researchers bringing it to the platform's attention. So I'm really hoping we move into a more proactive space. But I do worry that because there hasn't been this major financial incentive, that I don't know how incentivized the platform is.
All right. I want to say thank you to all of my guests, Luis Matsakis, who covers security and social platforms for Wired. Luis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Renee DiResta, policy specialist with Data for Democracy. Renee, it was a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
And Anthony D'Angelo, who represents the Internet Creators Guild. Not exactly a union. It's more of a guild. That's why it's called that. Anthony, thanks for coming on with us.
Great. My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And your channel, Lego Shark Productions. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington from NPR. I'm John Donvan, and for Joshua Johnson, thanks for listening. Listening.